Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And today I have two great guests, Linen Radchenka, also known as one half of the Infinite Studio, and Justin Curry, known the world over, as they'd like to say, as Jason Artwork. And I want to talk today about exposing yourself to feedback. So something that Mike Sanders, who was visiting one of my classes a little while ago, he's a filmmaker, among other things, and he was being asked by some of my film writing students a little while ago, what's the most important thing? And he said the most important thing is exposing yourself, getting a feedback loop. He called it a feedback loop. You need some sort of system whereby you are putting your work out there and getting feedback. And I want to just kind of dig into that a little bit, because I've noticed that with writers, especially, maybe it's true with artists as well, Justin can maybe fill us in a bit more of that, but I've noticed with artists, and especially writers I talk to, they often have a lot of anxiety about putting their work out into the world. And I think there's a natural reticence people have when they don't know if they're quote-unquote ready to put their work out there. A lot of people I just have noticed seem to have an anxiety or a frustration connected to, I don't know how I'm going to get my work out there. But then once they have solved that problem, they sometimes get into the other problem of, they just aren't comfortable doing it. They feel like they're exposing themselves. And they also just, are anxious about the feedback that they're getting. And so there's sort of three things that I want to kind of circle around. One is, getting feedback from your peers, getting feedback from your audience, and getting feedback from critics. So sort of, what are your thoughts on these ways of getting feedback? How much should you care? What should you care about? And so on. Why don't we start with you, Justin? What do you think about when you put your work out there? Could you maybe just talk a little bit about some of the ways you do that and kind of what you do with the responses that you get, if anything?
Yeah, when I think about feedback, coming from kind of visual background and training, my first thought is back to when I was in the graphic design program, we would do class-wide crits. So you would do a typography poster and you present it to the class, and then everybody would kind of take turns saying stuff they liked about it, what worked, what didn't. And I found those especially devastating, because you were getting kind of ripped apart by your peers. And when I think about why it hurt so much, or why it meant so much at that point, is because I was a fledgling artist without really anything in my portfolio yet. So anything that when I finally had something finished, it was, there just wasn't much else in my portfolio. So that one piece meant so much to me. So to have people say critical things about it hurt a lot more. The skin was a lot thinner. And as I go forward in my career and I have more and more and more, even if I have peers point out mistakes or flaws or something like that, it doesn't hurt nearly as much, because I have such a vast portfolio and so many things on the go and stuff like that. So I've just kind of analyzing how I deal with critique. That's something that comes up in my mind, is the more you have, the easier it is to take, because you have just a bigger portfolio to draw from.
Yeah, I was talking about that exact thing with my daughter once, where she had gotten some negative review of some book, and she had just was asking me about it, and she was saying how do you deal with when you get negative feedback? And I said, well, one of the things that I think is trips people up when they are just starting out is they have 10 poems. And so if somebody rejects one or doesn't like one, it's they're rejecting your work. It starts to symbolize, if you have just a couple things done in your portfolio, as you say, they sort of symbolize the totality of your portfolio. But if you have like 10,000, if you've written 10,000 poems, it's just another poem you've written. Right. So you might have an emotional attachment to it for other reasons. Like it matters to you that you wrote that thing or made that artwork. It's not that it doesn't matter, but it doesn't symbolize your art as a whole in the same way. And so if someone doesn't like it, it's like, well, if you don't like that one, maybe you like this one, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it starts to take less of the symbolic value of your artwork as a whole. And so you can be a bit more dispassionate about people's reactions, I find.
Yeah, it's so much easier to hear it, and then you can kind of analyze it a bit more critically and not take it so with like so much emotion to it. After like graphic design, I worked at a design firm and then a video game company where I had an art director or a senior designer who, like everything I did, they would find things wrong with it to fix. So, like, with my drawings, most of the time, people only say nice things. Oh, that's so cool. You're so talented. Good for you, right? And then going to a setting where, like, no matter what you did, there's things to fix. There's things to change. Like, this arm isn't looking right. Fix that. Change the lighting. Try this color scheme. Do this, do that. Like, their job is to find things to change, right? So going from just displaying art to like friends and family and kind of online and getting nice flowery critiques to in the workplace where it's this is business, this needs to be a certain level of professionalism, like you need to fix this. I'm really like that kind of stuff was kind of, it was a same thing. Like I took it a little personally at first because I think everybody does. But I'm so glad I went through a couple of years of that because I often think about that. Like now, even though like I don't, a lot of the times I'm not working with art directors or other people, I will try to analyze my stuff. Like what if this was in the video game company, what would they tell me to do over? If I was in the design firm, like what would they tell me to fix and fine tune? So I think it's really important to have some kind of structured, not like critique and feedback, but like that you need to fix this to make it better kind of feedback.
What about the dark side of that? Because the other side of that is a producer who's noting you to death, right? Because there is that side that where you've got a producer, like you see this all the time in movies, or you see most extremely in movies, where it's like, yes, there's a producer there. Yes, it is their job to give you feedback. But if they feel like if they're not giving you feedback, they don't have a job.
Right.
And like, so sometimes they have great notes for you and other times they're just giving you notes to justify their existence.
Right. They have to put their mark on it in some way, shape or form.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a justifiable side of it. Like if they are the producer and you're a hired gun, yes, it is ultimately their expression on some level.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that their notes are good. Like you can get in that situation where they're professionals. Maybe they know more than you. Maybe they're giving you good notes.
Yeah.
But there's also like the professional who doesn't know more than you and is giving you bad notes. And so how do you kind of deal with that or what do you, how do you know when you're encountering that?
Yeah. When I worked at the design firm, we actually had a note at one point, it was something along the lines of, my niece likes green. Can we try this logo in green? Kind of thing. Like we would get notes like that. And there is, you know, I'm two steps down the ladder removed. So there's nothing, I don't have any, I can't counter that. And so we had to do like just the whims of, you know, clients who know nothing about illustration or design, just throwing stuff out there. And we build them for it. And that I always, yeah, still to this day, I hate it. And it's part of the reason I don't do a whole lot of client work. And I finally reached the point in my career where that kind of stuff was very frequent as I started out. As I was getting my bearings, building my portfolio, starting my freelance, you'd run into a lot of clients that, yeah, you didn't agree with their artistic choices or their direction, but you know, you need to complete the job. And the more and more I noticed when I did my own thing and when I made my own decisions, I would, that artwork would turn out better. The poster would sell more than, just so I'd make more financially. And so I was kind of seeing like, you know, with numbers to back it up, my decisions making me more and doing better than like these client decisions. And it finally got to the point where I don't have to take on clients like that anymore. And the clients that are hiring me because they trust me to do the thing I'm good at and don't have as many notes. It's weird. Like the bigger the client, the less nitpicky and note they are. Like Disney and Netflix and Marvel, they didn't have a lot of notes, but friend of a friend who doesn't have any budget has a ton of things he wants to see different.
The other thing I wanted to chime in this respect is when it comes to receiving feedback like you're describing, one of the things that I've tried to keep in mind is that you need to have a sense of what you intend that project to look like. And so when you're receiving feedback, if you have the autonomy to reject notes, because there are instances where you are allowed to say no to notes and some where it's a client and you have to sort of do what you're told. If you're in a position where you're allowed to reject notes, you really need to have a sense of what your vision for that project is and be able to objectively look at the notes you're being given and assess whether or not those notes are actually improving the work or not, it sounds like you've developed, Justin, because as you said, over the years, you do what you want and you tend to come out ahead of some of the feedback that you've been given.
Do what I want, but follow my own intuitions.
Correct. You have a sense of the project.
Yeah.
But then there are going to be instances where, as you said, you aren't allowed to reject the feedback. And at that point, I mean, in a sense, when you're work for hire, it's not your project the same way. And so you have to recognize that it's not a reflection of your own work in the same sense. It's like, I've spoken to writers and editors who will say if someone reads a bad book, they very rarely blame the editor for it, which I think is true, because it's ultimately the writer in that position who has the final say on what edits are making it into the book or not. But in a work-for-hire project where the client is the one that has the final say, you're not necessarily going to blame the artist all the time for how that client project turns out. Like if McDonald's hires you to make an ad and you do what they say and it looks terrible, no one is going to say, oh, Justin did a terrible job at that. They're going to say, oh, that's a crappy McDonald's ad.
That's McDonald's. No, McDonald's might say that. But I see your point. I think you have to kind of, though, learn that, right? Like you have to learn by taking the notes, the bad notes, you have to learn what's a bad note. But I think you hit the nail on the head. Like you need to have a sense of whether they're making the thing better or worse, and that requires, I think, one, practice, but it also requires you to literally have a process of taking notes, and then you look at it. You need to get dispassionate about it, and I think your point is great. Like you have to have a level where your portfolio has to get big enough because you've made enough work. And you have to have taken enough notes from people that you can start to sense, you can kind of start to push your emotions about what you worked to the side a little bit, and you can start to look at it and like, is it working? Like, is it getting better or is it getting worse? And one of the uncomfortable things you have to get into is there, you do have situations where they're paying you to implement their note and your job now is to say no. Because your ultimate service to them is to reject their note. And it can put you in a real hard position sometimes, I've found. But it does sort of weirdly become your job at that point.
Yeah. And sometimes that's an easier conversation than others. Like I'm thinking of one example in particular. Earlier in my design career, I was tasked to do a logo. And the point of a logo is it's supposed to represent your whole company, right? And so this client in particular wanted a logo that had like a field, had a cow, had a barn, had these birds, had a duck, had him and his wife on like he wanted an entire storybook like crammed into a single icon. And so that's when it came, like rather than like rejecting the notes, it's almost like you now have to educate your client on... how this needs to function in the world, and all that detail is going to disappear if you're going to, like, you know, this is supposed to be made into like a little emblem on a shirt or a hat or a business card. Like, you can't do that. So you have to, in most cases, the really out there outrageous changes is more of like the client's ignorance as to how this works, more so than like they're just being stubborn.
And it's something that we run into in our book projects also. I know you and I have both at times rejected editing notes that were suggested to us. Jonathan and I had a conversation last week. I was doing edits for my recent or for my current upcoming book Hero Man, and one of the suggestions that the editor made essentially was neutering one of the jokes. And it was clearly because they didn't pick up the references that I was using. They weren't necessarily as familiar with the sort of pastiche parody elements that I was.
They didn't get the joke.
Right.
And so I'm not going to, you know, neutralize a joke and just have filler text instead. So I rejected the edit because with the, you know, explanation, this joke was missed and it weakens the work by changing it.
Let's just quickly to dig into that process. It's not that it's just you got a note and rejected it. It's that you got a note and you're like, okay, let me ask, you know, you guys, what do you think the basis of this note is? Are they right? You know, so you even got feedback on the feedback.
Yeah. I said, what do you guys think of this note?
Then you sorted like whether you thought our feedback on the feedback was any good.
Yeah.
And then that helped you kind of inform like the feedback, whether, how are you going to respond to the feedback, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a famous quote, and Gregory in the background of the studio will correct me on the source if I misquote. I think it's Neil Gaiman who said, often I'll get an edit that, and I'll reject the solution, but recognize that it presents a problem. The fact that I'm getting a note means that there's a problem, but I will often reject the proposed solution.
Yeah, I say that a lot, but I don't know where it's coming from originally. It's not. I know it's not something I invented.
Yeah. But that idea that if there is a note coming, and so I'm tying this into the example we're talking about, because I looked at their feedback that they were giving, or the note that was being suggested, and I didn't go with what they said, but I also didn't leave what I originally was using. I twisted it to fix it.
Because they weren't getting the joke.
That's right.
So that means some people aren't getting the joke now.
Yeah.
It's not like, because they're you know, readers, right? Like they're a cultured reader, they're an editor, you know, so they're a person who can read carefully, can read well. For some reason, the joke's not landing on them. It could be that the reference they don't get. But in this case, I would say it was an example where it wasn't dumb enough.
That's right. The joke wasn't dumb
enough.
It wasn't
obvious enough.
So I made
it
more dumb.
Yeah, because it wasn't obvious enough. It was just kind of, you know, and so, you know, but I think that's a great example of
someone is flagging
a problem
sometimes.
Yeah. And so what I've found with those kind of notes is I usually take one of two approaches. So either one, I'll just pretend that I did it.
Sure.
Sometimes with the client, that works.
It's true. I'm not going to lie. I've done that as well. Of the five notes I get, I
did three.
And they never come back to the other two.
Yeah, because really it was something else. And then once they see it again with like the three good notes implemented, they're like, oh, yeah. They just almost forget their original note.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's not a problem anymore. But the other thing that I'll sometimes do is like you're saying is I'll just make a different change. And that will again, solve the problem. Like again, often they're suggesting a note because they are trying to solve a problem, but they don't really know how to solve the problem, you know, but maybe, you know, that's
maybe
my
something
job.
Like this. Yeah.
I was going to point that out as well. Like not necessarily taking their suggestion for that change, but making a change there regardless,
yeah.
Right?
Because they've
like,
identified there's a problem here.
There's something not quite right about this. What about this? It's like, well, that idea sucks, but you're right. There is something not right about
this. How can I improve on your suggestion?
Yeah.
Now, we're talking about peers and professionals in this, or even clients, you know, which are kind of in that realm. But what about an audience? What about the audience is coming back to you, giving you feedback, whether it's, you know, hey, I love this, or, you know, I hate this, or something in between, you know, where they're coming at you in some way, shape, or form and responding to it. Like, what do you do with those responses? Like, how much do they matter to you? How seriously do you take them? You know, do you learn something from them? You know, what do you do with that?
I don't have the fame to comment on this the same way that Justin does. Justin has a much larger audience than I do, but everyone always says that you shouldn't make a work for a specific audience. You shouldn't chase a trend.
Everyone always says that.
Yeah, I know.
Some people say the opposite. Well, but the, people will say the same thing. They'll double speak. They'll say, "Oh, you shouldn't chase the audience." Then they'll also say, "Oh, you got to, you know, make work that your audience is going to respond to."
Right, because we're living in a product of capitalism.
I work for my audience. I love my audience. I'm trying to give my audience great things.
Yeah.
And then they also say, "Oh, but I don't chase the audience."
Yeah.
So how do you? I think you can reconcile those things on some level, but you know, how do you What do you pay attention to what the audience tells you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So. Primarily, I set up booths at Comic-Cons all over the world, and I showcase my portfolio of prints, and you can buy it as a 12x18 print, you can get it as a canvas, you can get these limited edition foils, and I'm in cities all over North America, and I've done Australia and UK, and people kind of vote with their dollars, right? Like, if people really like a print, they're going to buy it. And if they don't like it, or they don't get it, or they don't want it, then they don't buy it. So it's an in-person interaction. So nobody is ever offering negative feedback in person. It's kind of like, you know, the anonymity of the internet, when you'd never say those kinds of things to somebody in person, right? So when somebody sees you're the artist in person, they only ever say good things. But when a piece isn't working, it just never moves. Every time I come up with a new piece, I will put it front and center. I will make it like the most obvious piece on that table. And after a couple of days, hundreds of thousands, sometimes thousands of people have seen that piece and nobody comments on it or likes it, then I know that this piece was kind of a dud. So that's kind of the feedback that I'll get.
And how do you feel about that, though? Like, does that mean you're never going to make a piece like that? Or does it, you know, break your heart a little bit? Or do you just think, oh, maybe there's something wrong with it, it needs to be better? Or like, how do you respond
when
that happens?
All those things, yeah. So sometimes, like, okay, I tried this direction and I'm proud of that piece, but like, people don't want this on their wall. And that's okay. And again, it goes back to like, I am pumping out two, three paintings a month. So if one of those paintings is a dud, it doesn't matter because I already made like four more by the time it sinks in that one's a dud.
Yeah, you might still like it, but for some reason they don't.
Yeah, for some reason it didn't work.
It'll come back around.
Yeah, and that's happened as well. So I've retired pieces and then brought them back and suddenly they're selling. And then other times I've done a piece and I know there's something to this, people aren't buying it. But okay, I'll go back in and I'll adjust some things. I'll change colors. I'll change like a bit of a feel, and suddenly that piece catches on. So that's happened a handful of times as well.
Do you ever have this? There's like, say, two pieces on the table, and somebody comes up and is looking at piece A and like, oh my God, I love this. I love this so much. It's so great, amazing. And then they buy piece B instead.
Yes. Yeah. People come. Oh my God. Yeah, I really like this. This is amazing. But I'll get this other one.
Give me the Balrog.
Yeah. So
what do you think that is about?
I don't know. Yeah. It's we often talk about at the studio how I'm primarily a poster artist. I have lots of prints and posters, but I also have graphic novels. And something that always kind of irks me at the table is I have pieces that I've spent 70 to 200 hours on, and then I have pieces that I'll do in a day. And it hurts my heart a little bit. Like, it's still my art. I'm still winning. But when people take the piece that I spent a lunch hour on over the piece that I spent hundreds of hours on, because, you know, it's just, that's not working for them. And this is, and it's the same with books, right? I put months into this book, but it's hard to sell that book. But this poster that you did in 2 hours, 11 years ago, I want that.
Give me the Balrog.
Musicians often complain about that.
Yeah.
They'll complain that their hit song is the one they wrote in 10 minutes. It just came to them, they wrote it, they're like, oh, it's not even a great song. And then that'll become the hit. Whereas the song that they worked so hard on, you know, it took so long, you know, they labored for a month, it's like nobody listens to
it. We don't want
to
hear your new stuff, just play the ones we know.
Yeah. Just play Freebird.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some of them embrace it, and some of them, you know, just don't. Like Kurt Cobain stopped playing Teen Spirit.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're all kind of chasing that, right? Like a print artist especially, like you'll have a piece that'll light the convention on fire and you'll sell out of it like twice. I've done pieces where I had to reprint it not once, not twice, but three times in a weekend. And that's amazing. And when it happens, it's great. And then I think I'm always kind of chasing that. And after doing this for over 10 years, I still have no idea when I'm painting a piece if it's going to be that or not.
Does it change what you make? Because you'll sometimes do series, mm-hmm. you know, although I don't see you necessarily do series. I don't know if that's really tied to people's responding in any way, shape, or form. Because you seem to do a lot of them, and then you'll show people them.
Yeah, I think like there's, when I plan out a piece, I usually have an idea of how I could make this 3 or 4 prints, but I'll finish the one, I'll see how it does. And then, so actually just recently I finished, so it's my 10 year reunion of being Chasing Artwork coming up in a couple weeks.
Ooh.
And yeah, so I did an original piece of a computer, kind of an exploded view of an old computer with a bunch of plants. And goldfish swimming around, just like a fun abstract piece. And I had a lot of fun doing it. I like drawing electronic stuff. I like exploded views. I like drawing plants. So just kind of checked all these boxes. And as I was making it, it's like, this would be really cool if there was this computer and then another piece where it's an old radio that's been exploded and there's little songbirds. And then another one with like an old camera that's like, so I have like this 3-part series planned out based on this one piece that I just had fun doing. And so in a couple of weeks in Calgary, if I sell, you know, 10, 15, 20 of these pieces, that's huge. So I know there's a demand for whatever this was that just tickled my fancy.
Your Terminator piece sort of has that similar aesthetic.
Nobody wanted that.
Really?
Nobody.
But nevertheless, you made more pieces that have a similar aesthetic.
Yeah, so that's it. I'm still chasing. There's something to that aesthetic that just did not work.
Chasing Artwork.
With Terminator. I thought, like, I love Terminator. I thought this piece is going to do well for sure.
You think people don't recognize it as Terminator for some reason?
It's pretty obvious. I don't know.
I would think so, but I was just wondering. Because it's not like Arnold.
So much like Lisa's
work. Do you think that... you care fundamentally though about how they react?
Absolutely I do, but that whole, again, it goes back to it, I don't have to put as much emotional weight into it because I know even if this piece flops, these other ones are going to carry it. These older ones for sure are going to carry it. So I'm in this amazing position where I can kind of do whatever I want. Something's going to work and something's not going to not. But in the end, it all kind of evens out.
Yeah, you're not going broke if they don't like it 1 year. Whereas, you know, somebody who's building the career a bit more or is in an earlier stage, you know, I think often they have a sense that it really matters more so how people respond to it or they're chasing a certain response, whether it's smart or not.
But I think it's so important to experiment, right? If you're really, really concerned about that, you're not taking risks and chances. And I think what's great about like what we're doing at the studio here is we're doing what we want and what we're passionate about. And if it's a financial success, great. But if it's not, we have that like solid foundation to,
sure.
Yeah. So we get to keep trying new things.
Yeah. Like I don't care that much how people respond to things, but I do pay attention.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, cause I'm trying to engineer certain responses. So like, I want them to kind of be confused at this point. I want them to be angry at this point. I want them to think this joke is funny. So like, I'm really attentive, you know, in that sense, which kind of gets me into a weird position sometimes because I'll get annoyed about it. Is if they have the exact response I want them to have, and then they think I've done something wrong. Like when I get critics review my work, who are mostly very kind, once in a while it'll be like I'll get really like upset about the particular critical response. Like I'm talking like a critic reviewing your work, because they'll say like all the things that they'll basically like list all the reasons why it worked, and then say it didn't work.
Right, like they cut down to the foundation of, they see the bones of the
they
project.
They don't see it, though. Oh. They think that they're producing an engineered reaction that I've engineered, and then saying I'm not in control of their reaction.
Ah, gotcha.
So it gets up, you know, I just get annoyed about it. But do you ever get like, have you ever had that sort of, you know, critical review response where people are like, saying like Justin Curry, and here's why Chasing Artwork is great, or here's why Chasing Artwork is the worst. You know, like Like, and I don't know if there's that much, I don't know if you really have venues for that in the art world in the same way as writers get book reviews.
Is there an artist equivalent for book reviews?
Yeah.
Not as much, because, yeah, we're kind of, the Wild West of Comic-Cons, it's basically like the indicators for success are there people walking around with your artwork, with your product, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if I don't like Gregory's artwork, if I see his artwork walking by my booth all day, every day, yeah, I know he's winning, right?
Yeah. Sure.
So here's my question as I've been sitting here. Like you said, Justin, you have, it's easier to take feedback, especially negative feedback, when you have so many things that you can be working on. But for someone who's newer in the field and doesn't have that wide pool that is going out and they're doing their first show or they're submitting their first book, like how do you prepare someone like that for their first round of probably negative feedback?
Rejection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you get ready for rejection?
How do you get ready for your first rejection?
I liked it because, well, I didn't like it, but I'm just saying, like, how I got ready for it, I guess, is the way to put it, is I was reading a lot of, what really helped me was reading Stephen King. Mm-hmm. And particularly Stephen King has these short story books that he would put out. And at the end of the book, he would always write a little blurb about where the idea from the story came from or where it was published. And he would like list things like that. And I remember one of the books reading it, and he mentioned, this story was rejected by, the New Yorker, and then it was published, somewhere else, in Esquire or something. And I remember like reading this and thinking, oh, Stephen King's still getting rejections, yeah.
Still.
And then he had also written elsewhere another part about like how when he started writing, he would get all these rejections, and he put a nail on his wall and he would post them on the nail. And then at a certain point, there were so many rejections, he had to get a railroad spike and like start posting on the railroad spike. I remember reading that and thinking, so it was just because he was talking about the actual process of getting rejected. And because, of course, flash forward, Stephen King succeeded and did well.
Yeah.
And I'm reading his stuff and I think it's good. I that carried a lot of weight for me, like that another writer was open about talking about the process. And I just started to realize like, professional writers get rejections. So if I get rejections, that means that I'm a professional writer. And I started to, it just sort of took the air out of it for me, on a certain level. So like, yeah, it was still kind of annoying. Like I remember getting rejection from Weird Tales, and Weird Tales had this, really sent me this great typewriter rejection. If people go to my website, jonathanball.com, and search Weird Tales, they can find the rejection. I like scanned it, put it up there. And this is, and I go into like why I liked the rejection and all the great things about the rejection and how to kind of read a rejection in certain levels. So, but it was just so exciting to get a rejection from Weird Tales. Like the editor of Weird Tales read my story.
Yeah. They came across their desk and
they didn't like it, but they read it,
But yeah, I think it's just important to go into anything with realistic expectations, right? If you're only ever going to take your story and submit it to one place, like already you've kind of failed in my books, right? You need to take it to a whole bunch of places. And yeah, there's so many stories of famous authors, and like J.K. Rowling, right? Like nobody wanted to touch her books, and Stephen King, nobody wanted his short stories. And so going in knowing that everybody kind of flubs those first couple of tries, and that's just part of it, right? No, you're not going to be perfect out of the gate.
Yeah.
What do you say to the people though who, because I've seen people like this where they'll get their thing is like, well, if someone's going to reject it, why even send it?
It's part of growing and learning and being a person. Especially like if you want to be professional and be serious about this, like can't have that mentality.
Yeah, I really, it's not.
And they think they're not ready. They're like, well, I'm not ready, so why send it?
Yeah.
So not necessarily in direct response to that, but there every once in a while I come across someone online or a message board, etc., who says, I sent this into XYZ. Let's say I got sent this into Image Comics and got rejected. What do I do? Well, what do you mean, what do you do? Or how do I feel?
People do. You're right, though. People ask that kind of thing all the time. And how would you respond, Lennon? Like if you putting aside the temptation to respond, now you're going to actually help that person.
Okay, so I'm trying to help them. I'm not just trying dunk on them.
Well, not just dunking on them, but, you know, let's just like, yes, I agree. They shouldn't be posting that. Let's just put that aside for a second. You know, they've come to you in a private moment, and, you know, it's the proper...
They're not coming to me. They're coming to a public
internet
setting, but yes.
They should not be doing that, but let's just put that aside and imagine that instead they were doing the proper thing.
Sure.
And saying, Lennon, you know, I've been, you know, I submitted this thing to Image Comics. I just got this rejection back. It's, you know, upsetting. You know, what do I do now? I don't know what to do next.
All right, so you want my polite response then.
Your polite
and it is,
response.
Well, rejection is part of being a creative. You can't always control the circumstances in which your book gets published because it's a combination of where's the market at, what resources are available to the publisher, where do they see your book fitting into the marketplace, and...
Even that particular person. Like, yeah. Maybe you just caught the wrong guy on the wrong day.
Correct.
And if you were to apply again in 3 months, it'd be a completely different person.
Yeah, you can't necessarily predict or understand, comprehend why your book got rejected. And so what you need to do is decide what you want to do next with that book. Where is the next place that you want to send it to? What is your plan to continue to produce this book? Are you going to continue to produce this book, or were you banking on an opportunity that is statistically like winning a small lottery? When you looked at your outlook as a creative, did you consider the very common story that people get lots of rejections, and did you expect to be the exception to the rule?
That ties your point of like, you have to have realistic expectations. Some people honestly believe that, oh, if I just write this thing, it'll get accepted and published. And then once they get rejected, they're like, wait a second, I never considered the possibility that it would get rejected. And, you know, it's just a level of delusion that maybe is, you know, maybe it was good for them. It got them to the point where they finished that thing. But now they have to kind of, you know, get their head screwed on properly and, you know, just kind of be more realistic about the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And doesn't mean you should stop sending it around.
Right.
It may in fact mean you should send it everywhere. But you got to do other things at the same time. You
right.
Know?
That's the point that always, like, when somebody just has the one book that they want to make, I'm already kind of writing them off.
Yep.
Because, yeah, the idea of just having one story in you and being done and that one story being any good, like, I can't see that.
Good.
No, like you're...
It happens, but...
I was talking to a mentor in comics this week, and we were talking about a rejection that I had received recently. And the rejection... Like, we briefly touched on a rejection, and then his first question was, what else are you working on right now? So that you can... Like, while you're continuing to shop this project around, it's not the only thing that you're focused on.
It's a
and you had
process.
A long answer for that.
I had a long answer a for long that, answer. Yeah.
Right, because you never know how things are going to do. Like, I think like there's a level where you kind of have to, you have to have, so one person, this writer, Casey, reached out to me and she was asking me a bunch of questions. One of her questions was, she goes, if I've got a movie script and I'm pitching it around, and I want to pitch it around, you know, to try to get it picked up or sold or whatever, she goes, if I'm writing another script, should I wait to be done a few scripts before I start pitching them around? Hmm. Or should I just, you know, pitch one around, you know, before I start writing another one kind of thing? And like, so on some level, the question becomes like, is it worth writing a bunch of stuff before I pitch anything? So,
but even on a more granular level, like I'm currently constantly in the process of pitching a novel draft around. And it's common to read in the submission guidelines, you may not hear from us for 6 months after you send this in. So what am I supposed to do for 6 months? Because if you're pitching a novel, the manuscript needs to be finished. You're not working on that book anymore at that point. So if you're going to submit a book and then sit for 6 months and wait to maybe hear a response, like you can be doing other things with that time. You're not just going to sit and do nothing for 6 months.
Yeah, without getting deep in the weeds of it, I think what you need is to understand that the process of pitching things to people or submitting things to publishers or putting your work in front of the audience, you know, that whole process of getting feedback, you know, from reviewers or audience members or customers or peers, like that's its own process. And then the writing process is, you know, the main process. know, creating things is your main process, and then you also need a separate process for getting things out into the world in some way, shape, or form. And you got to be doing both those processes. You know, you got to be running them both. You can't just be doing one and not the other. But a lot of people do. A lot of people are more comfortable with one versus the other. And so they'll just focus on one versus the other.
And I'm not saying that you need to be, you know, in the midst of working on a project. I'm not saying, because there are some people that will jump from project, between project to project to project to project, be working on four or five things at once. I'm not saying that that's necessary, but you should have a plan when you finish your project A. You should know what you want to work on next, and so that you can start on project B.
Which usually, like, happens in the middle of project A. You're going to come up with project B, C, and D.
Right,
in the middle, and, like, want to jump ship, but then, like, that professional aspect comes in of like finishing A
right
before going on to B, C.
Yeah, it's such a writing stereotype, like to a meme level, with where people will have five work in progress projects that never get finished.
They never,
because they're doing A, they get three quarters way through that. They start on B, they get halfway through that. They start on C, they work on D, and then nothing ever gets finished. And you know, it's something that my mom used to say growing up, which was that it was important to always be working towards something. And it was okay if the plan changed, but that as long as you were working towards something, you could pivot and not be stuck waiting for something to come to you, because that isn't something that works.
My daughter, when she was in her university degree and she wasn't sure, I remember we had a picnic during COVID at one point, and she was like, we were like in some sort of weird park that was also a cemetery or something. It was very strange. But anyways, she was like starting to stress out, because she's like, I don't know if I want to continue this degree, or do I want to switch my, you know, major to this other thing, or, but then I don't know like what I want to do for a job, and I don't know what I'm going to do to this. And I just said, you know, I go, it doesn't matter. it doesn't matter. Like, guess worst case scenario, let's say you switch to your degree. I go, and then you decide, you know, that you should have just kept with your old degree field. I go, your worst case scenario is you go back to school and you get a second degree. It takes you an extra year. Like, who cares? And at the end of the day, like, yeah, what are you going to do? Like, who, like, as long as you're moving forward in a direction, as long as it's not the absolute wrong direction, you know, like you're going backwards, but as long as you're kind of moving in like the vague direction
but really
that you want to be,
as long as you're not closing doors,
right? And I was always like stressed that idea, like, why don't you just apply whenever she's like, well, maybe I should apply for this, maybe I should apply for this, I'm like, just apply for them both. You go, yeah. You could always say no, you could always offer you the job and you could turn it down.
Yeah,
you could always get in the program and decide you don't want to go. You know, like, what does it cost you, $20 to apply, you know, or whatever? Like, it costs you the time, it costs you maybe a fee, but like, keep, you just have options, and when you have the options in front of you, you know, then you can decide which of these things you want to do. But if you keep closing doors, as you say, like, it becomes a hard thing to do. Unless that's part of your strategy, like, you know, I like to close certain doors, but that's just so that I don't, you know.
So you're not led into temptation?
Right. No, honestly. Like, but you know, that's because I now know kind of what I want to do, right? Like, if you aren't really sure, you know, what you want to do or how people are going to respond, right? Just go back to that feedback idea. Like, if you're not really sure how people are going to respond, like, yeah, why not make five pieces and just put them all at the table and see what they like?
Yeah.
Yeah. One of my first pieces of advice I give artists who are starting out in the illustration, whether for their portfolio or for a table at like a Comic-Con, is shotgun it. Try a bunch of different things. You don't know what the audience is going to react with. You don't know what you're going to enjoy doing most. So just try a bunch of different things and something's going to stick, but make a bunch.
And you don't even know what you're good at. I often tell writers, like, you should just write a bunch of different types of things. You might have in your head, oh, I want to write vampire novels, but maybe you suck at writing vampire novels.
Ha.
Right? Or maybe no one wants them. Maybe they're dead. Maybe they're a dead genre. No,
people love
it's
the vampire genre, as I'm going to set out to prove.
But maybe they don't anymore all of a sudden. Right? Like, if it's your whole life, and that's the only thing you think you can do, like, it's kind of a tough position to be in.
Yeah. My shortcut to wrap my thoughts on seeking out feedback is just expect to get rejected. It's not that hard. Just expect that they're going to say no. And if they don't say no, then great. You're in great shape. And if they do say no, well, you weren't disappointed.
Yeah. Just bouncing off that, I think one of the things that's really important to understand is that their feedback isn't your work. You know, you can, if you get constant negative feedback and nothing but rejection, it still doesn't really change what your work is. It may be that they don't get it. It may be that they're right, maybe that they're wrong, but like it doesn't really have to affect anything. Maybe it should, but it doesn't have to. Like you can just keep doing the thing you want to do. You just might not make any money. How would you tie it up, Justin?
Man,
what's your last thoughts on feedbacking?
I think I've reached the point in my artistic career that
he doesn't get rejected.
Well, no. I'm okay with rejections, right? The next five pieces I make, I know one of them is going to be a dud, but I still need to do that dud in order to learn something small from it that's going to make the next great piece better. So I think I see rejections and missteps as stepping stones towards better projects in the future. So like I've done entire books that I don't think were like turned out as great as they could have been. But hey, I learned a lot along the way, and I'm going to take the lessons I learned with that dud project and bring it into the next project and make it better. You're always after that better project on the horizon. Rejection's a part of that.
I like to say you could always write another book. Like, you know, if this one doesn't work out and it sucks and everyone hates it, just do another one. Like, but again, to your point before, if you haven't got a body of work, it's hard to understand that.
Yeah.
You need to do enough work that you can understand in your bones that if everyone hates it and it sucks, and they're right that it sucks, they should hate it, you could just make another one. You know, so this has been writing the wrong way. Keep writing the wrong way and keep exposing yourself to feedback and keep your wits about you.